It's appropriate to begin with an explanation of why it is important to discuss the history and practice of natural family planning in the context of a course on Catholic bioethics. And the reason for this is that without this background, without an appreciation for this very important subject, the Church's teachings on the subject of human sexuality, and especially its opposition to contraception and to many of the new reproductive technologies, can seem unjust, inhuman, and in general rather incomprehensible. It's only against the background of the Church's encouragement of natural family planning that these other modalities can be seen as the defective and problematic efforts they are to subdue and to dominate the created order, rather than, as the Church invites us to do, embracing and cooperating with what God has made. One of the reasons for reviewing the history of natural family planning is so that we can understand why there exists such widespread ignorance and even opposition to the practice within the Catholic community. Appreciating its history and what was available at different times can give us a clearer sense of the work that needs to be done and of the misconceptions which it is important for us to help clear up. In general, it can be said that natural family planning is based on the possibility of a woman knowing when she is fertile, and the couple, the married couple, deciding on the basis of that knowledge whether they wish to make use of intercourse in order to conceive or to avoid having children. And as we've seen from our brief glance at Humanae Vitae, the decision to limit family size is a perfectly legitimate family decision. So all of these methods will be based on the question of and the identification of fertility. Let's begin with calendar rhythm. This is a method which, in general, when natural family planning is taught, one speaks of in the past as a somewhat problematic and limited and even primitive form of family planning, which was available and is still available, but which represents a kind of an early development in the tradition. This is true, and the limitations of the older calendar rhythm method tended to give the whole area of natural family planning a bad name, as we shall see. But if we look at its development, it began in the 1930s, and roughly at the same time, a Japanese gynecologist and a gynecologist in Austria, Kiyosako Ujino in Japan and Hermann Knaus in Austria, noted and published their observations that in women with regular cycles, ovulation, that is the release of the egg during the cycle of fertility each month, precedes the onset of the woman's menstrual period by a consistent period of 12 to 16 days. And they were able to devise a method which enabled a woman to try to anticipate when her next ovulation would take place, and to estimate a number of days both before and after that event that would enable the woman to know that that intercourse during those days would likely result in, or could result in, the birth of a child, but avoidance of intercourse during those days would be on what were referred to as the infertile days. Now, the great drawback and limitation with this method is that it depends upon a woman having a regular cycle. And in fact, a great many women do not, and with the modern stresses and strains of society, women can find that their cycles are irregular for a whole variety of physiological and psychological and sociological reasons. So to attempt to predict based on last month's data does carry with it a big uncertainty factor, and for this reason, the calendar rhythm method had a certain success rate, but it also had a significant failure rate. And for this reason, it is not generally taught today by people who teach natural family planning. Now, there's one exception to this. Very recently, in 2002, an adaptation of the older calendar rhythm method was introduced, which is called the standard days method. And this is described as being much more accurate and much more effective than the older calendar rhythm method. If one looks at this and sort of puzzles about it, the reason for it, of course, is that the people who have devised this are convinced that in the developing world, it's more difficult to teach women symptoms that enable them to know when they're fertile, and therefore a simple calculation based on numerical days and using a device such as this series of beads will enable them to to follow a method that will actually work for them. It is stated that this is a much more accurate method than the older calendar rhythm method, which again was based on a presumption of a regular cycle. However, I don't intend to say anything more about this other than that it does exist, but that it is a relatively new development and that it is not generally taught by the individuals who teach natural family planning in the context of the Catholic tradition, although it was devised at Georgetown University and again is thought of as being helpful in the developing world. What I'd like to focus on rather than this is to follow the historical development, setting aside the more recent standard days method, and note that calendar rhythm was available in one form, but contraceptive technology suddenly became available before any other reliable forms of natural family planning appeared. As you'll note in number two, in 1958, Dr. Margulies developed his Margulies coil, which was one of the earliest intrauterine devices. In 1964, the Lippi's loop became available, again another intrauterine device. And then in 1960, the Food and Drug Administration approved the first oral contraceptive pill, Enovid. And that meant, of course, that these forms of contraceptive device were available before the publication of Humanae Vitae. I might mention, and we will look at contraceptive devices in more detail, especially at their side effects, and they're highly problematic, although oftentimes disguised, problematic effects on women's bodies. The Dalkon Shield, which was introduced in 1971 as a variation on the already existing intrauterine devices, turned out to be not only dangerous but in many cases lethal. The intrauterine device functions primarily by irritating and creating a sort of an unnatural state in the lining of the uterus and therefore making implantation difficult but not impossible. Women have conceived and born children despite wearing intrauterine devices. It also unfortunately takes a sterile space and introduces the possibility of infection into it. So there are terrible problems, and again the Dalkon Shield was the primary representative of how very bad intrauterine devices could be. It was a rather horrific chapter in the history of contraception. But let's then drop down to number three, and that's the promulgation of Humanae Vitae, which we've already looked at. And remember, this was in 1968. So what was available at that time was uterine devices, the oral contraceptive pill, and calendar rhythm, which was not an entirely reliable method. So at that point, many of the conclusions and emphases of Humanae Vitae, beautiful and important though they are, were rejected by a large part of the Catholic faithful because they claimed that this meant that the Church was expecting them to make use only of a method, i.e. calendar rhythm, which was known to be somewhat unreliable. So in general, unfortunately, Humanae Vitae came on the scene just as general contraception was becoming available, and it appeared that the Church was not offering a good alternative. Now let's drop down to number four. Basal body temperature charting has its own history from the 1940s to the 60s. There was an effort to collect and analyze basal body temperature charts. And again, these are charts of resting body temperature. It has to be checked at the same time each day. The best time is in the very early morning, just before a woman gets up. They are checked not with an ordinary fever thermometer, but a much more carefully calibrated thermometer that allows for much more precise measurements of smaller increments between individual degrees. These were analyzed, again, during the 1940s and 60s, and it was determined that one could use these temperature observations to determine fertility. It was discovered that a rise in temperature and the days that were noted during which this rise took place could be used to calculate fertility. Now, notice that I'm going to use the word fertility and not necessarily the word ovulation, that is, the moment or the day on which the egg is actually released. The question of fertility is much more complex than just the question of ovulation. Now, the basal body temperature methods are able to give a fairly good impression of when ovulation takes place, but one cannot say with absolute certainty exactly when it happens. However, fertility also depends on a number of other factors, and in particular, it depends upon the presence of a fertile type mucus present at the opening of the cervix, which is the opening into the uterus, that allows the sperm and even encourages the sperm to be transported into the uterus and then further up into the fallopian tubes, which is where fertilization takes place. So basal body temperature is not just about ovulation, it's about a measurement of a symptom, that is temperature, which is related to the broader question of fertility, the ability to conceive. From the 1960s to the present, a simpler form of this method became available. And without going into detail, again, it has to do with the measurement of a number of days in which there's a rise in basal body temperature. And the real development in this method took place in the 1970s when it was combined with the observation of other symptoms in an organization which eventually became the Couple-to-Couple League, founded by John and Sheila Kipley, and I've given you a website address if you want to visit their site and discover more about both their history and their methodology. And their approach is called symptothermal. They primarily rely on the basal body temperature measurement, but they also take note of and try to integrate into their method the cervical mucus observation and several other symptom observations as well. Now, again, notice that there is a significant lag time between the publication of Humanae Vitae and the availability of these methods. It wasn't until well into the 70s that the symptothermal method became known and taught in ways that could make it widely available. If we drop down now to number 5, the ovulation method, or the Billings method, also called the cervical mucus method, was devised by Dr. John Billings and his wife Lynn in Australia, and they particularly took note of the symptom of the presence of cervical mucus at the opening to the woman's vagina. It's a very simple observation, simply based on observing the presence of mucus when the woman goes to the bathroom, goes to urinate. And this very simple observation enabled them to, rather like what was done with the observations involved in basal body temperature, to note that a woman's fertility is very closely linked to changes in the cervical mucus, which can be described and very easily categorized. And you can see off to the right of the picture of the Billings, the circular kind of monthly chart, which we'll look at in a little more detail, which represents their graphic depiction of this method, which in fact is again very straightforward, very easily taught. Mother Teresa of Calcutta taught it to many thousands of women in India and had very great success with this method, which is based only on observation of the cervical mucus. It does not involve any observation of the temperature symptom. And this method, the Billings method, is taught as it was originally described by the Billings and is available in a book that describes it, which is published by Liturgical Press in Collegeville and in other formats as well. But it has also been raised to another and higher level of sophistication as the so-called Creighton method through the efforts of Dr. Tom Hilgers, an excellent OBGYN physician who practices in Omaha at the Pope Paul VI Institute. And his Creighton method is an adaptation and a development of the Billings method, which makes an even more careful and specific and systematic assessment of the mucus symptom. And as we'll see when we discuss treatments for infertility, he's also very strongly supportive of methods of treating infertility that are completely compatible with church teaching, which he calls naprotechnology. So the ovulation method, or the Billings method, is primarily known, again, in that form, or as the Creighton method, which represents a further development and higher level of sophistication of these methods, which requires teaching by those who are associated with Dr. Hilger's Institute in Omaha. A word should be said about effectiveness. As we'll see when we look at contraceptive technology, there is a difference between so-called use effectiveness and method effectiveness, meaning that if the method is used perfectly, one achieves one kind of result, but if one simply teaches the method and then asks everybody, are you using it, and then attempts to see whether it's successful, that would be more like use effectiveness. And method effectiveness for both the ovulation method and for the basal body temperature method in the form of symptothermal, that is to say, where one is looking at both symptoms, achieves higher than 95% for those couples who are seeking to avoid pregnancy, up to 99%. And this is as good as, or I should say as effective, as the oral contraceptive pill. However, this success, these statistics are only achieved by those who are using the method and are using it with full knowledge of the fact that intercourse on fertile days can result in conception and intercourse on non-fertile days will not. So if someone is supposedly using the method but ignoring what they see, then that would result in a lower statistic of success. And the lower statistics are variable in terms of how they're published. I should add, and we may have a little more to say about this, that one of the difficulties in the Catholic community is that one has these two primary methods being taught, the Billings or Creighton method, which looks just at the cervical mucus symptom, and the symptothermal method, which looks both at that and at temperature. And there tends at times, unfortunately, to be a certain rivalry, sometimes an attempt to say that one method is more effective or better than the other. This does not help the Catholic community. My own suggestion to seminarians is that they find out who is teaching in their area, who is competent, who is both effective and good at communicating, and make use of those individuals. One might also add that sometimes people who regard themselves as more scientifically sophisticated prefer the symptothermal method because they imagine that having more data somehow will make the observation more effective. That's not necessarily true. Sometimes having more things to try to integrate into your decision can make things more confusing rather than more straightforward. But again, both the Creighton method or the Billings method on the one hand and the symptothermal method on the other achieve excellent results, as good as are available using any other technology if one's goal is avoiding pregnancy. And as we'll see, the other very important benefit of natural family planning is that it is extremely useful for achieving pregnancy. It is a very effective means of dealing with infertility. The next important step in the development of the Catholic understanding of the vital importance of natural family planning, it really is constituted in the theology of the body of Pope John Paul II. And this takes us from the late 70s into the mid 80s. What the Pope did was to take the theology of Humanae Vitae and expand it in a tremendously effective way, as we've already mentioned in passing in a couple of previous lectures, providing what he called a total vision of the human person, or an adequate anthropology, which means a development of the potential ideas, such as the communion of persons within marriage, the possibility of making oneself a gift to the other, that allows the tradition of the Catholic approach to the natural family planning, the question of cooperating with nature, the interrelationship between the both the reproductive and the unitive aspects of human sexuality, to be highlighted and integrated into a much clearer theological and spiritual framework. So it's really only with this, which is now, only just now, becoming more widely available and more widely known, that the whole significance of natural family planning as a part of the Church's teaching and of the part of the Church's vision for human persons can be most clearly articulated. And then, as I've pointed out in number 7, the current development in all of this really consists in making the various modes of natural family planning more known and available through modern technology and different forms of teaching. I've given you the address for a fertilityfriend.com, which is one website which makes available things like apps on this for calculating and understanding fertility. Now, there is one difficulty with all of this, and that is that nothing can substitute for the personal touch. That is to say, having a personal teacher, having a woman who can teach another woman about the various symptoms that she's observing. And so, from the standpoint of the best forms of teaching, it's always best to have a couple-to-couple or a person-to-person contact in the experience of teaching. But again, these technological efforts can make this wonderful modality and approach more widely known and to some extent more accessible, and then hopefully can encourage people to seek out the teaching resources that are available in their area. And let me summarize by highlighting something that I hinted at the very beginning of this lecture, and that is that the time frame that we've just looked at makes it comprehensible why there still exists a whole generation of Catholics and also a whole generation of many teachers, of priests, especially within the Church, who simply do not know that natural family planning is effective. Many of them, when they hear natural family planning, unfortunately think that one is speaking of the calendar rhythm method, which, as we've seen, has been significantly superseded by these other much more effective and much more scientifically validated methods. Nonetheless, that ignorance persists, and it's coupled, as we shall see in a later lecture, with the reluctance to speak about these matters that unfortunately causes this element, this very important aspect of Catholic teaching, often to be ignored or to be regarded as something that is actually embarrassing. And against this background, we'll now turn to a closer look at the basics and the biology of natural family planning in our next section.